I'm Corey. This is KISU.org. On Sunday, November 10th, Bengal Theater and Pocatello Film Society will show the film David Crosby, Remember My Name. The film was directed by A.J. Eaton, who grew up in East Idaho.
So you asked, like, how a guy from Pocatello makes it to directing a movie like this. Well, you know, I grew up outside of city limits, and my dad, his name is Steve Eaton, and he's a songwriter, and he's a musician who had come to California and had made kind of a small name for himself as a songwriter and an artist, had a couple of record deals. He, at one point, was asked to write a song for this documentary that was about small towns in Idaho in the Northwest that were kind of vanishing. They were like mining towns or whatever, and now they're like ghost towns. And I remember the filmmakers had gotten his name or whatever, and they came to our house, which is up on Buckskin Road. He had a recording studio up there, and they'd set up a machine to play back, and he started writing this song, and he came up with all these musical ideas. And I remember seeing that and seeing them put moving image and music together. And I was like, that was something that was so magical to me. Ever since then, I became obsessed with the kind of the alchemy of putting music and moving image together. My dad was like, you know, you ought to check out some soundtracks. And so he bought me a John Williams CD at Budget Tapes and Records, which I think is still in existence. And I would like save up money and I would buy a CD. At that time, you could buy a CD before the movie came out a couple of weeks. And so I would go home and I would listen to these soundtracks and I would like think about, wow, what's this movie going to be like in this scene? Like, was the music scary or whatever? So then I kind of like sought out every type of opportunity in Idaho that I could, using some of the people that my dad knew. And, you know, I went to grade school and junior high in Pocatello. So I found like Channel 12 and I did some like stuff there, which was great. I mean, it's an amazing thing that Pocatello has like a community access television station where someone could go down and check out a camera and produce their own program and get it on the airwaves. So then after that, I started editing and I started working as a camera operator at Channel 6.
Last Friday, I went to Hooligans, all right, downtown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and all the major Pocatello decision makers, right? All the big time was there, right? And we were talking about you, and we're talking about the movie, and we're talking about the Eaton family. And Mitch Papa, that name popped up, and he said that he worked with you at the TV station. And he kind of helped you with the camera stuff.
Yeah, Mitch Papa. He was involved in Channel 12.
We were talking, and he thinks that you should put him in the credits of the movie, you know, as an influencer. That was one of my more serious questions. Is there somebody in this area that kind of influenced you or helped you out along the way?
I did take some classes at Idaho State University. You know, I took a lot of photography classes there. I had a really great professor at Idaho State named Tim Frazier, who is a brilliant guy. Photography professor who has education in engineering and then also a fine arts degree in photography. And I think that print lab probably is still in existence there on the university campus. And I remember oftentimes he and I would get engaged in these neat philosophical discussions about art. And I remember him saying, like, you know, you've got to take your art beyond your first impression. When we would get like an assignment to go and shoot something, through the course of our photography classes that were like, go and shoot something that is cold. Like your first impression might be like a woman shivering that's snowing or something like that, or an old man with like icicles on his eyebrows or something like that. Like that's where my mind would go. So I would shoot that and he would go, well, yeah, but that's pretty typical. Now what's beyond that? What's more cold? Maybe it could have been like an image of a person's breath being caught in the air, or maybe there's a completely different thing. So it really caused you to think, and that really caused me, like, from a filmmaker standpoint, from a director standpoint, and I think we kind of did that with the Crosby movie. If someone just said, "Here, we want to make you want to direct a David Crosby movie," and the typical person be like, oh, 1972, you know, like you could do that. But we went beyond the typical. We went beyond the first impression. which is we took some chances, and I think it paid off.
How do you think your East Idaho upbringing kind of helped shape you into the director that you are? So sort of as an interesting thing, I went to the, you'll like this, I went to the Farnsworth TV Museum up in Rigby.
Oh.
One of the things I thought was so fascinating is they said that Farnsworth invented TV in Rigby, and he could only do it in Rigby because if he lived in a bigger city or a bigger town, he would have been influenced, or he could have been persuaded in a way that could have eventually distracted him. And so it worked, kind of coming from a small town, worked in his advantage. And I was curious to see if you kind of rang true with that statement as well.
Growing up outside of city limits and where we did live, we had 13 acres, and we were up high in a mountain, and we only received one TV channel through a terrestrial antenna. We didn't have a satellite dish like everyone has these days. So instead of like being stuck in front of a television with hundreds of channels and all of that, or we didn't have, you know, our iPads and iPhones, and we didn't have the internet at that time. I mean, I'm dating myself a little bit, but we're forced to use our own imaginations to create. And so my brother and I were like immersed into art, and my brother Marcus is an awesome guitarist. He discovered the guitar and started just worked his fingers to the bone studying and playing his guitar. And then I found a video camera. We just learned to create and use our imagination. So I'm thankful for that idea of isolation. The idea of isolation is the mother of invention.
How did you get interested in David Crosby? And what drew you into him where you thought, you know what, a documentary would be good to get going?
Good question. I met David through my brother, Marcus Eaton. Marcus is an amazing guitarist. Crosby called Marcus one of the best singer-songwriters in the business. And in his guitar playing skills, like he does all this finger tapping stuff, and his technique on guitar is like borderline virtuosic. When Crosby and my brother met, we both were like, this ought to be interesting, because, you know, I had heard about David and his background with drug addiction, and I knew that he had a liver transplant. When I met him, he was 68 years old. And so I wasn't really expecting much, but what I saw was very inspirational. I saw a guy who was making his first solo album in 20 years, an album that was called Cross. And my brother was working with writing a couple of songs on that album and singing with him. And then that ended up my brother going on the road with him. I, as a filmmaker and a storyteller, could see that there was an interesting story right in front of me. And that story was that this guy is basically like in his third act reawakening, his third act renaissance, and someone should shoot footage of this. And so I said, hey man, what we should shoot some footage of you guys working together. And he was agreeable to that. And so the minute that I came in with my camera guy and me and he and I were shooting back and forth, I asked Crosby a couple of questions, and then his answer was just really, really interesting. And I could tell that he was ready to talk. And so for a couple of years, as I was out in LA, like working on other projects and pitching other screenplay ideas and pitching other movie ideas, I was shooting Crosby enough where finally came time for us to really get serious about financing this movie. And I was realizing that Crosby really is living on borrowed time. I mean, every time he goes out on the road, he's putting his life in danger because he's a fragile person. He's got nine stents in his heart, and he's had a liver transplant. He's got diabetes. He's had two or three heart attacks. He's trying to be as healthy as he possibly can, but liver transplants usually last 6 years, and he's 20 years past. So we were working on trying to get financing for the film and get the right production team together. Through one of our executive producers, a lady named Jill Mazursky, I was at Jill's office, and there was Cameron Crowe. I'm a huge fan of Cameron Crowe, and I love Jerry Maguire is definitely up there with one of my all-time favorite movies. It's such a great movie. I was like, that's it. Cameron's the guy. That Cameron would be perfect, dude. He's like the Rolling Stone journalist, of course. And Cameron and I sat down, and I told him what my idea was, and I gave him the pitch, and I showed him some footage and all of that. And he could see what I was seeing about Crosby, which is that he's ready to talk. Cameron said very smartly, he's like, Why don't you interview him? Because I've interviewed him a number of times, and he's always given me the best interviews. And I was like, of course, Cameron Crowe, you got, like, absolutely. The minute that Cameron came in and I could see this conversation happening between Crosby and Cameron, which was different than the conversation that I was having with Crosby myself. And so, you know, a good director, your job is to get the best performance and get the best material and get the best conversations out of people. I could see that Cameron was right. He knew that Crosby was ready to talk.
It's interesting you bring up asking those really deep questions, you know, and I've only watched the preview of it. I was wondering about what was it like when Cameron Crowe got real close to the bone and was asking those real sensitive questions, or Crosby was given a real emotional answer. I was wondering what that was like for you because, you know, you're a director, you know, you want to get a shot and you want to make sure your audio is right. But there had to have been times where you were like, well, wait a second. It was almost like all the equipment just evaporated and the air got sucked out of the room.
We had many moments like that where I think the ones that come to my mind are when even stuff that wasn't just Crosby. I mean, Jan Crosby, as you will see, I mean, she's a saint. She's an angel. And David is alive because of her unconditional support and love for the man. And when she sat down at her kitchen table and said that some of the things that you'll see in the movie, I couldn't help but just, I had to just kind of go outside and take a walk for a second or just get some fresh air, because it's, you know, this isn't just a movie. These are real people's lives. It's real. And it's every time I've, you know, the movie premiered at Sundance and David and Jan were there with me and Cameron Crowe, and then it played in a number of festivals, Boulder and all of that. And every time she watches the movie, she has to relive all of those moments from their legendary life. And it's hard for her. Pull the scab off and, you know, it's really hard. But the thing about Crosby is that he did not... Cameron asked Crosby. Crosby says that, you know, we asked him some of the hardest questions that he's ever been asked. And I think you'll see that some of those questions are there in the movie. He never said at any point, I don't want to talk about that. Nope, I'm not going to answer that. He would take a deep breath. He would look down and he would think about it and he would give you an answer.
What did you learn from watching Cameron Crowe do an interview like that? I mean, because not only did you do a really great job of documenting David Crosby, but you also in a way kind of documented how Cameron Crowe prepares for an interview and kind of how he did, you know, what was the process like? Did he compose questions, do stuff pre-interview, and maybe your involvement with that as well?
He and I definitely talked about how I saw the movie coming together and how I think that the structure of the movie would be. For instance, we wanted to have him talk about his father. We wanted to have him talk about his childhood growing up, which would then lead him into his teenage years and meeting Roger McGuinn and Chris Hillman at the Troubadour and starting the Byrds and, you know, being 17 years old and hanging around with the Beatles and becoming famous and like, and that kind of stuff. And just like Cameron and I were working in conjunction together, we was like, let's talk about his childhood and let's talk about his this and let's talk about his parents and let's talk about his, the first time that he, you know, whatever. I mean, I remember Cameron asking Crosby, when did you lose your virginity? I mean, we went pretty deep, all of that. And so we knew that we wanted to have a banked all of these interesting stories. And at this point in time where Crosby, his faculties are all there, his memory is great. And he's a great storyteller. And then when we went through and we edited it, one thing I learned as a film director, especially a documentary, you have to go and shoot footage and only to find out that you don't need it. Again, we go back to Tim Fraser at the photo department. There was something he said, something about you can gauge the quality of a photographer by the size of their trash can in their print lab, which means that they're discarding more than they're keeping. But that helped us hone in and keep sculpting this story, which is a portrait of an artist of David Crosby. When you're doing a movie like Crosby, it's a Herculean task because you've got hours, 30, 40, 50 hours of interviews that you've done. And then you've got all of this archival footage that our archival research team has to source and find. Those interviews were then kind of, we used those as the construct to put together this narrative. The other thing that was really great about working with Cameron you know, he definitely is like kind of almost a character out of one of his movies, especially Jerry Maguire. He's so, you know, he's really enthusiastic and he's very positive. And so he and I were, once the movie really started, we started honing the story. You know, he and I were in tandem in that edit bay with the editors. And it was great to kind of work with him back and forth. And he could say, well, you know, at one point I had to do this with this movie that he directed or that movie with he directed. And I was like, wow, you know, and that's stuff that you put in your director filmmaker toolbox that is priceless. And it was really, really great. And, you know, Cameron is just really enthusiastic about this genre and this story. And Almost Famous is a story that's inspired by Cameron being himself the 16-year-old kid journalist going on the road with a rock and roll band. And that rock and roll band was Crosby, Stills, and Nash. There are lines in the movie that you hear from the band and you go, God, that's quintessential Crosby. Like that's right out of Crosby's vernacular. I felt like I was tapping into some amazing, like, new library of so many cool discoveries to be had because of that. But what was really cool with the production is that I think I broke a record as far as music cues in a movie, because there's so much music in this movie. But there's also places where Crosby's music, we needed to go beyond that. And so Marcus, my brother, I brought him in. Marcus wrote these beautiful solo guitar pieces that are just so heartbreaking and profound. And you'll hear those sections in the movie. And it was like, wasn't a big orchestral piece and it wasn't a big overtly sentimental or dramatic piece, but the most effective and beautiful thing was this Marcus on his guitar, and it just works so well. And I think it kind of brought things full circle in a way. Marcus was kind of the thing that kind of started this, like opened up this world, and then it was neat to kind of bring him back in at the end when we were in post-production to write this, like put some musical punctuation on this interesting paradoxical story.
I love that picture that you guys have of the poster and of the DVD. And I feel like that there's so many stages of the Crosby, right? You got the birds, you got the CSNY, you got him as a solo artist. He's like sort of an ambassador for current cultural events. Then there is the man who he is off stage. And I was curious to see what stage of David Crosby's career do you find the most intriguing, or kind of where you hang out the most, where you're fascinated with and you're checking it out.
He's like a cat. He's had 9 lives. And, he's had so many fascinating, fascinating stages, and he's lived such an epic life that it was hard for us to contain it into 90 minutes, into one set feature film. We could have done a multi-part, because he's also done a number of amazing things. Like, he's an avid political activist. He's an avid anti-nuclear waste activist, which affects folks in Idaho, you know, because Idaho is a place where they're storing a lot of that. He's got really good intentions. Everything I included in the movie, or I should say everything we included in the movie, I find moments are so fascinating. So, but I'm really inspired by what I call his third act renaissance. He's had a lot of stuff that he's not proud of, and yet he's set that baggage down, as he says, and he's decided that he's going to continue writing music and keep writing music, because I think that's what's keeping him going. And it just so happens that the music is so beautiful.
I know that the topic of David Crosby is kind of a hot topic, you know, and a lot of times people kind of, you know, and he talked about it in the previews where a lot of people shy away from him and he shies away from other people. So what was that like, getting other people in the film?
One of the cool things I think that we did with this movie is that we took some chances, and I'm proud to say that we didn't take the typical approach to telling this very epic and paradoxical and kind of complicated story. And one of the decisions that we made early on is that we didn't want to do a parade of all these talking heads. We didn't want to do a VH1 Behind the Music. We wanted to let David tell his story. And oftentimes when there's other types of movies like this, they'll find someone who was like an iconic figure of the time to give their like social commentary, like, oh, David Crosby was the man with a big mustache. And we all thought, where did that mustache come from? You know, but instead we let David tell that story. It's sad, and you'll see in the movie, but it's unfortunately the members of the Crosby, Stills, Nash and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young are not really speaking right now. And so we used interviews of them from archival footage, but we didn't do any new interviews because we felt like it would be, we wanted to take the bold approach. We're going to let David tell his story.
Did you guys think about that? Did you think, hey, let's hit up some of his, what they're doing now and kind of get or were you just like, let's not even cross that bridge?
We did, but when we definitely considered it, but we didn't want to get into a, like, I remember it this way, you remember it that way, he remembers it that way, you know, whatever. We wanted to let Crosby hold, tell his own story, for better or for worse. We were graciously, Graham Nash and Stephen Stills and many of his other collaborators did allow us to use their music, but they also were just said that, you know, hopefully you can make it honest because they're not speaking.
What did David Crosby say to you after he watched the film, or what was that interaction like?
Good questions. You know, when you do a movie like this, you have to protect your objectivity and independence, and you can't, you know, you can't let your subject be in control of the movie, or otherwise it becomes a commercial or it just becomes a fluff piece about that person. When Cameron and I really got serious about this, honing in on this story, Crosby didn't have any editorial say on the movie. And so we were deep into editing. We were combining thousands of hours of archival footage and old found film footage that I had restored at Photochem and Technicolor, and given my background in film printing, even some of the classes that I took at Idaho State helped me be knowledgeable about that. But moreover, Crosby was calling me a couple of times. He's like, I better hear, you better be showing me stuff right away, right away. And I was like, just hold on, Cros. You just wait right there. You know, I'm not going to show you anything until it's ready. And he'd hang up on me. And finally, one day I said to him, I was like, I can't show you a scene of the movie. It's like playing a bridge of a song. I have to show you the whole thing. Just give me the chance to show you the whole movie. Trust me, you're going to love it. And so he and Jan came in and they watched the movie, and I could hear them laughing and I could hear them crying. And again, it's hard for them to watch their life, which is parts of their life which are not fun to talk about because, you know, things that you will see in the movie. And he kind of, the lights went up in our screening room and he turned around and he looked right at me and he was like, what can I say on the college? What words can I use on this college radio station? So he liked it. But the first time that he saw it with an audience was at Sundance. And that is an entirely different experience. And, you know, we're there biting our nails going, we have no idea how people are going to actually perceive this. And when when you're cutting a movie, be it a documentary or a feature film, you know, you show it through a number of, you know, you have a number of people come and look at it, you get take notes and all of that, but you really never know how it's going to be perceived until you show it for the first time in front of a huge audience, like our premiere at Sundance. And so it was like this, like, warm standing ovation. And so I hop up to do a Q&A and I have Cameron Crowe with me and David Crosby again, like, pinch me, like, what? And, Crosby, for the first time, and Cameron and I talk about this all the time, we looked at each other. For the first time, Crosby was like in front of an audience and just at a loss for words. And he was taken aback, and it's hard for him to see a warts and all depiction of his life, the good and the bad, you know, for the good and the bad. I mean, this is a really, I have to hand it to David that he courageously and honestly answered the questions the best that he could.
What do you hope people walk away with?
Well, that's a great question. I hope that maybe people will be inspired to call their long lost friends that they haven't talked to for whatever petty reason. And, you know, and think about their own interpersonal relationships. I hope maybe there's some phone calls that happen and say, hey, so-and-so, it's John. I know we haven't talked for 10 years, but how are you, man? And let that go. So I hope maybe it'll inspire people to do that.
Now that you're at the spot where you're at, do you have people that reach back out to you that are like friends that are like, hey, you remember me? Or do you have like maybe some girlfriends that were like, man, I wish I didn't break up with that guy. You know, now look at where he's at.
Yes and yes.
Love it, man.
Also, like, I'm glad to have had the experience that I had growing up there. And I'm glad to have had known the people that I knew at the time there. And my grandparents worked for the Union Pacific Railroad. They were brought there. My grandfather was in the Air Force, and there was an air base in Pocatello. And so he and my grandmother were Italians, and they immigrated, and he joined the Air Force and ended up in Pocatello. I had a really beautiful childhood up on Buckskin Road, and I wouldn't change it for the world, man.
How often do you come back and visit East Idaho, Pocatello?
It's kind of hard to come back, but I do yearn for the romance of that is Idaho and East Idaho. So the last time I was there was, I came up and I showed the movie in Sun Valley in March, and I'm an avid skier. And so Shea Butler and I have been talking about I need to come up and take some runs up on Pebble Creek. It's been a minute. Right. And I miss Lava Hot Springs, especially.
Yeah. Right? There you go. I love that, man. That's all, yeah. Yep, that's a hot spot. Well, no pun intended there. But
mm-hmm. I might be doing another movie that's inspired by experiences I had growing up in Idaho. So stay tuned on that.
There's going to be some people who will go check out this movie. And, you know, people that live under a rock, they might not know who David Crosby is, but they might go see it because around here they say, oh, there's a Pocatello kid in there. This might be a chance for you to kind of clear the air and to give a disclaimer to some people that, you know, clean cut kid from East Idaho. And all of a sudden, you know, they watch this movie, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. You want to come clean on anything, you know,
well,
warn some people.
I'm sorry, but the movie's rated R, you guys. There is a lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll in this movie, so I can't. I'm sorry.
How long did you have to hang out with David Crosby before you could start calling him the Cros?
Well, probably, you know, 6 months or something. Everyone calls him Cros.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of he loves it.
Yeah,
and it's a great nickname, and it works. And in fact, that's what they called that album.
Yes,
that it was the first album in 20 years called Cros. It's not just a nickname; it's an attitude. You know,
yeah, right.
I've been signing like all my emails and everything. Live Crosingly, you know, Crosley, and because you know he marches to the beat of his own drum
for sure.
That's both a great thing and also kind of a challenging thing with him. But he's his own man. There was no one like him before him. I'm really happy that we found this moment in time where the window was open for us to tell this story at this time. And it seems like so many people are responding to the story because it turns out that this music means so much to so many people.
On November 10th, Bengal Theater, along with Pocatello Film Society, will show A.J. Eaton's film, David Crosby, Remember My Name. For more information about KISU radio programming, scheduling, news, visit KISU.org.